Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending upon where in the world you are and what time of the day you're listening to yet another episode of Talking the Blues. I have George in south of France. Good afternoon, George.
Hi, Paul.
And I have Andy in southwest Warrington, I'm guessing.
No, northeast Warrington, but never mind, it's Warrington, sunny Cheshire.
Hello, Andy. How are you?
I'm good, Paul, thank you.
Good. Okay, well, look, we've only got two more games left of the season.
Thank God.
Yeah, what are we going to talk about for the next 6 weeks? Anyway, before we get to that point, look, we came into a Project Restart with a degree of optimism that we might actually make a late tilt for European qualification because aside from the Derby match, the fixture list actually looked quite kind to us, and there was a feeling that we'd had a good break from in during the lockdown. It hasn't quite worked out that way, has it?
Not at all, because the dream, if you like, of Europe has certainly disappeared all too quickly in the last four games. And probably, much as we want to be in Europe for all the reasons of we need that level of competition, we need it to attract better players, we need it for financial reasons. It's probably now, with the way certainly the last four games have gone, it's probably a blessing in disguise that we haven't qualified to Europe because we've struggled against
relegation
Well,
candidates.
yeah, exactly. I mean, I didn't see the game against Villa, first game I've missed visually all season, but I listened to a radio commentary on it that was hard work. It must have been hard work, to be fair to Darren Griffiths and Ian Snowden, who were commentating on Everton radio. It must have been hard work for them. And when Ian Snowden says with about a minute before Theo Walcott equalised that he couldn't see us scoring because we hadn't had an attempt on goal in, what was it, 88 minutes, I thought, dear God. You know, but
we've had lots
for
of
me,
attempts
for me,
on goal, just none of them on target.
yeah, for me, that for me, this Project Restart cannot end quick enough. I just want it over and done with, and,
Yeah, but that's not, that almost sounds like, we have to face the problems we're literally faced with. I agree with you. It'll be, this kind of empty stadium football. I've had enough of it. But it is Everton Football Club are where they are.
Yeah.
At the moment, and whether it's Project Restart or full-blown football,
No,
it's pretty grim.
I accept that. When I say I just want it over and done with. It's Project Restart. I want over and done with. It's not football per se. I just this charade of a final third of the season, with no crowds and drinks breaks and nine-man substitute benches and five changes, etc., etc. To me, it's made a mockery of the game. So, the sooner we get back to normal football, which we don't know how long that's going to be, the better. But, I mean, from Everton's point of view, yes, they've got two more games. We've got Sheffield United and Bournemouth to come, and somehow they've got to try and do something in those last two games to give us a little bit of hope going into the summer break, and into the period where no doubt Mr. Brands and Mr. Ancelotti are going to be extremely busy. I don't see them getting much of a summer holiday this year. You, I mean, you watched the game on. You watched the game against Villarreal. Tell us how you saw it visually as against what I heard orally.
They'd all had a sort of, public. There was a lot of public talk. Seamus and Ancelotti had gone to Pickford, and he definitely asked for more, and they gave it for 10 minutes, and then very, very slowly the wheels fell off. There was an article I read this morning pointing out that in the last two games, well, in the match against Tottenham and the match against, well, must be the last three games, Iwobi, Sigurdsson, Gomez have not made a tackle. So your hopes that something will happen in Sheffield United and Bournemouth are probably misplaced, I would say, Andy. The, you know, it's a shambles. The only good thing, let's talk about something positive, that came out of the match against Villa, which, you know, in terms of wanting it, which we've all seen loads of times, Villa wanted it. They needed it more than Everton, that's certainly true, but they wanted it more, and that was shocking, again, to watch. But the only positive that I saw, and I should be so disappointed if Ancelotti doesn't react to it, is that at 1-0 to Villa with 12 to go, he takes Sigurdsson back to do the collecting the ball off the centre half because nobody trusts him to pass it properly, which is unfair, and sends Gomez up to join the forward line. And Gomez caused 12 minutes of havoc because he likes to run with the ball and he likes to attack people with the ball and he's good at it. And suddenly he's completely energised. He looks about 3 years younger. And he's causing mayhem. And he provides three crosses, I think, and an assist for Digne to put another one in, including the one that got the goal. And he created a chance that I'm sure Dominic Calvert-Lewin, if he was on the line, would go, yeah, yeah, I should have put that away, man. And I will be in despair a bit if when we tip up against Sheffield United tomorrow night, Gomez is not pushed forward. He's not a tackler either. You know, you can't get booked that many times and be that good a tackler. So it was pretty grim. Pretty grim.
Yeah, so if we've got a midfield that collectively isn't making a tackle, as we've suggested in previous podcasts, that is the biggest area of concern for the summer, for the trading that's going to have to happen.
Without question. Can I just morph into my first question of the week, which is, I watched Ancelotti talking to some journalist on some podcast or on a broadcast saying, as I'm sure we all know, that the board are going to back him with his obvious needs. Couldn't be more obvious. Where does this sit with financial fair play and the PL rules and half of certain Everton supporters' websites thinking that Mashiri's just got to open his handbag? And what are the facts here, please?
The facts, George, are that in order for us to buy players and be compliant, we have to sell players, and effectively we can balance off the profit that we might make if we sell players with the costs associated with buying players. To buy players and not sell any puts us at great risk of, you know, not being compliant. Now, financial fair play doesn't apply to us in the sense that we're not going to be in European competition next year, and the regulations have been allowed to go forward 12 months anyway. So nobody at this moment in time is actually going to be looked at from an financial fair play point of view.
Right.
We still have an issue, though, with the Premier League rules. And the Premier League rules are far more lax than the European rules are. And the Premier League rules say... Yeah, they say that you can lose 105 million over a three-year period. The European rules say 30 million euros. So there's a big difference between the two, and I think we're very close to that 105 million figure, if not over it. It depends what you can take out of the accounts, because certain costs you don't have to apply to the rules, but we're very, very close to it, and therefore, even if the club had money in the bank or money from Mashiri, it makes it very difficult for us to spend significant amounts. And by significant, you know, I'm not talking £50 million. I'm talking sort of, you know, £10 to £20 million on each player. Well, I don't think we could buy three players £20 million each. We don't have the money for that, and our cost base is just too high. We can't do that.
And if you did, what punishment can and would the PL deliver?
Well, the Premier League have never been in a position where they've had to fine somebody or deduct points or penalise a club, because nobody's actually ever got to the point where they've broken that particular rule.
Right.
Just as it is with UEFA, you know, there's a disciplinary committee, and that disciplinary committee has the discretion to put in any penalty it wishes, and that, you know, that can be a financial penalty in terms of you know, fining the club. It can be a points deduction if they felt
forcing
necessary,
them to necessary play behind deduction. Closed doors.
Indeed, you know, in the EFL, they've gone down the points deduction route with clubs that have broken their financial fair play rules, and obviously in the English Football League, they would do that because those clubs don't have any money anyway. So to try and punish a club financially that has no money doesn't make any sense. So they just go down the points route. It's untested waters because nobody's been there. Now, the likelihood the likelihood is that, you know, Mashiri could probably convince the Premier League that because he's prepared to back the club, that there's not an issue. But as I say, that's untested. Nobody knows.
Right.
My question would be whether or not we want to support the club, whether we want the club that we support to be in a position where, you know, it's right up against the rule book. Because I don't, you know, speaking personally, I don't want my club to be in that position. I don't care that, I know it's somebody else's money and it's not my money personally. There's a risk here. I just don't like the idea of our club being in the position that it's in. I always like to think that our club would be in control of events, not events controlling it. And unfortunately now, events are controlling what we can and cannot do. I mean, quite clearly, we need a lot of players to come into what is a very, very poor squad. But that's not going to happen. And even Angelotti saying, I'm going to get the support of the board, that doesn't mean he's going to get the number of players that he might wish for, or indeed the quality of players that he might wish for. And that's what I mean by events controlling the club. We are not currently in control of our own destiny. The very well-run clubs, Manchester City, Chelsea, okay, they have fantastically wealthy owners, but they still have the same rules and regulations that everybody else has. They're in control of their own events because they're well run. Brentford is a fantastic, sorry George, just one last point. Brentford is a fantastic example of a club with limited resources that has put a business plan together that says we will develop players, we will buy very young players, or we'll bring them through the academy if we can do so, and we will sell a number of them each year in order to make a profit. And there you have a very small club with relatively limited resources that's both profitable, developing players, playing good football, and potentially could be in the Premier League next season.
They must have a really good coaching.
Yeah,
regimen. If they're reliant on bringing youngsters through, developing them in order to sell them and make a profit,
The scout to find the initial talent must be good, and then the coaches to develop them from potential into reality must be absolutely top draw. If that's how they're working their business and they're making it work, because they've just moved into, or they're moving into a new stadium as well, aren't they?
Yeah, that is an absolute monstrosity. I don't know if you've seen it when you've been.
I have. It's right at the side of the M40, at the side of the A4.
As you go over the Hammersmith.
Hammersmith. Well, I mean, that's what I'm saying is, if their business model is we need to develop to sell, then and they're making it work. They must have really good scouts and a really good set of coaches there to make that work.
But that's like your friend.
Which begs the question: Why aren't we bringing? Why aren't a club, you know, like Everton, who've historically brought players through, bringing more through?
Well, I think it's a lot to do with what that mate of Paul said on the other podcast. Is it Richard? When he said there is a philosophy running through a football club. And you can, you know, Paul's just outlined what Brentford's philosophy is. I don't believe we've got one.
No.
We're caught between, we've got loads of handbag, let's, open inverted commas, waste it. And now put ourselves in a position where we can't even spend the handbag that we've got, which is, you know, there is no... When we, you know, that, I think that's why everybody talks about the Everton way, because it doesn't exist. It did, but it doesn't at the moment. So there's a nostalgic way of looking back and going, oh, you know, which is no use to anything or anybody.
See,
and that's, I think, why we're not doing that, because, as you've said before, the under-23s are there for glory, not for providing for the team. We'll buy for the team, you know. Do you know what I mean? We're caught between being Man City and not even Brentford.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, it appears that if one or two of the under-23s are able to step up, great, it's a bonus, it's the cherry on the cake, because the cake is winning the under-23 title and the under-23 FA Cup. Not those achievements being a bonus on top of four or five or six of the under-23s every year, you know, making it to the first team squad or being sold for decent money. You know, we've developed to the point where...
Are you implying, Andy, and I'm not putting words in your mouth, that Brands would rather Unsworth wasn't there?
I don't know. I can only speak for myself. I certainly can't speak for Marcel Brands, but I just don't, you know, whilst it's great that David Unsworth has won, is it two under-23 titles and, you know, that's great for him, for his CV, but in terms of what it's done for the progression of those players into the first team, to save us having to keep going out year on year, year in, year out, spending money, it's not worked. You know, the couple of players that have come through, you know, they've not set the world on fire, and we haven't been able to turn them over for healthy sums of money. I mean, I look at Solanke at Bournemouth, who was with Liverpool, who played in that under-23 side with Calvert-Lewin. Okay.
Yeah.
And he was never going to make the grade at Anfield, so they sold him to Bournemouth. £21 million they got for him, and he's only just scored his first couple of goals for Bournemouth in the last week or so. You know, but he wasn't good enough for their first team, so they sold him, but they got very, very decent money for him. We haven't sold any. We haven't brought somebody through who's not going to make it and then managed to been able to sell them for that kind of money. If we'd had, you know, there was the other one, that Jordan Ibu also went to Bournemouth for something like 15 million. There's 30 odd million on two two bit part players for Liverpool. Well, if we'd been able to raise £30 million on the back of Joe Bloggs and Fred Soap for coming out of the under-23s who weren't going to make it, you know, we wouldn't be in the position now where we're struggling to give Ancelotti the financial backing that he feels he needs. Now, I take the board will back me. I think they probably will. I think the board will probably say, fine, yeah, go out. We've got these 10 players we need to get rid of. Get rid of them and you can bring in two or three to replace them. I don't see them say, as Paul said, are we going to sign three £20 million players? No. Unless we raise £60 million from the players that we no longer want or that we need to move on. So he'll get the backing, but is he going to get the checkbook backing or is he going to get the, yeah, we're right with you, just make it work. Make it work by selling what we need to get rid of. And that puts all the onus then on brands, I would suggest, more than Ancelotti, to continue the wheeling and dealing that he's done since he's been here. I mean, at the AGM back in January, February time, he said since he arrived at Everton, he's completed something like 70 deals, which is too many. Well, by the end of this summer, he might be up around 80-plus.
He said it was too many, Andy.
He said it was too many. He actually stood up at the AGM and said, this is too many. It's not right that we're going through that many deals.
Well.
So if in order to provide a potential £60 million for three £20 million signings, he's got to out 10 players at an average of £6 million apiece, he's going to be a very, very busy boy. Because it's a buyer's market, not a seller's market at the minute. I don't envy him, and that's why I say, whether he's got issues with the way that David Unsworth runs the under-23s, that's for them two to resolve. But it's not helping the club as an entity that the last rung of the ladder before the first team appears to be cracked, and any time somebody stands on it, it collapses under them.
Then I have only one other thing to ask, because I don't quite understand where this is going. David Unsworth is in charge of what essentially is the Everton reserve team, right?
Yeah.
All he can do is coach them to be the best team in that league. Are you suggesting he does something different, which I can't work out what he's doing wrong that you're unconvinced by, if he's getting results which could not be better?
I think he has to be he has to create a feeder club.
Yeah, that's a different thing, is it? A different mentality?
Totally different mentality. It's about getting the players who are in the academy, getting the under-23 players to play in a style, to learn football in a style that's consistent with how the first team coach wants the first team to play. So if it's getting a bunch of midfielders used to playing in a 4-4-2 or a 4-3-3, whatever is the preferred formation of the first team coach, that's what he has to do. If it's learning zonal marking, learn zonal marking in the under-23 side, where, frankly, it doesn't matter if they lose a game 4 or 5-0 if they're learning something from it.
Yeah, I understand. I understand. Thank you.
That's what successful clubs do. That the whole focus of the organisation must be on supporting the first team.
Yep.
To provide the first team manager with the tools that he can work with. And if the tools coming out of the under 23 side aren't up to scratch, then we've got no option but to keep going into the marketplace, and that's just more and more money.
There's another reason at this particular time and next season as well why this approach is so important, because with five permitted substitutes and nine people on the substitutes bench, you're effectively...
You imagine that's going to stay, Paul?
Yeah, that's going to stay. That's in next year.
Oh, okay. Right. UEFA don't want it, or FIFA don't want it. Is it FIFA have said they don't want it, but they've acquiesced, and the five from nine is in situ for next season.
Correct.
What, just in Britain or all over Europe?
I don't know, George. I haven't
seen. No, I'm not sure, but certainly in the UK.
Haven't seen
elsewhere.
Okay,
fair enough.
In the Premier League. So it becomes even more important that more players in the club, not just the sort of 11, 12, 13, 14 players that would have normally been in the first team squad, understand the way that the first team coach wants to play football.
Absolutely.
And if
you know, I mean, I don't know David Unsworth, and I've got no reason to be fair to him, but I would allow him the argument, well, excuse me, how do I know what we're going to play? The guy's only been here 10 minutes.
Then why isn't he asking, if that's the situation, then why isn't he talking to Ancelotti about what do you want from my boys to help you in 12 months' time? Where do you want my players to be in 12 months' time when you're going to come looking to try and draft two or three of them or more into your squad? What do you want me to do with these kids?
I could not agree more, Andy. Totally. And if that conversation hasn't happened, I would want heads rolling as to why that hasn't happened. That surely was the second conversation Ancelotti would have had.
But isn't that part of the job of the director of football?
I was going to say it's a combination of all three, really, isn't it? Because Ancelotti should be telling, well, between them, you know, they're the three senior coaches, if you like. You know, the coaches at the lower level will probably have a much more, I would imagine, a much more structured ladder. The problem area appears to be the jump from under-23s and a successful under-23 side to a struggling Premier League side. So maybe Mr. Brands, Mr. Unsworth and Mr. Ancelotti need to have some serious conversations if they haven't already had them. And if they have already had them, they need to go over them again to make sure that all three of them understand what the other two have said.
Mm-hmm.
Because maybe there's a communication breakdown somewhere.
And maybe, as regards what Paul and you were saying about Brentford, maybe our scouting's not up to it, Andy.
I hate to say this, but I've thought that for a long while because, you know, I hate to say it, but I keep looking at Old Trafford and seeing the likes of Mason Greenwood and Marcus Rashford coming through and, you know, that play with confidence. Complete confidence. Maybe it's the mindset. I don't know. Maybe our scouts are just not finding these youngsters at 15, 16, 17, or even younger. I mean, Rashford's been at Old Trafford since he was about 12, I think.
Yep.
You know, why? I mean, look, have we got anyone remotely close to Phil Foden at City?
I would say he's probably a bad example. He's a world-class footballer in the making.
But he's come from the back streets of Manchester, hasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. No, somebody found him.
Yeah, somebody found him. So if you know, are we not looking far? And I mean, you know, we even brought in, you know, we brought in Ademola Lookman, didn't we? We bought him from Charlton Athletic, and that didn't work out for whatever reason. We're either not scouting properly, or we're not doing right by them when they're with the club.
You know,
That brings us on to the statements that Carlo Ancelotti's made in the last 24, 48 hours about Moise Keane.
And he's what's he said?
He's our player, and you know he's taking time for him to settle in, etc., etc. But he's got the talent, and you know he's our player, and he'll be here next season. He's kind of squashed the fledgling talk that you know maybe Moise Keane will be moved on in the summer.
Okay.
You know, Andy, I don't often disagree with your like footballing assessments. I think there is some evidence that we've done okay in player development, not to the extent that we should do, of course. But you know, I think if you look at Holgate, if you look at DCL, and now if you look at this young kid Branthwaite, there's a partial case at least for saying, well, we have developed, you know, some players that either cost very little or have come through an academy into, you know, what looked like, I mean, it's obviously very, very early for Branthwaite, but what looked like, you know, good Premier League footballers.
The only caveat I would put on that, Paul, is that Holgate came from Barnsley, DCL came from Sheffield United, and Branthwaite's come from Carlisle. How many have come up through the ranks, if you like a Tom Davies?
No, I'm not for a moment suggesting that it's the work of the academy with those three individuals. I'm saying actually, you know, we've scouted those people, and you know, we've done well in scouting them, and we've helped them develop their careers whilst they've been here. So I think you know, it's just a sense of balance, really. There's lots of players I think that we should have developed their careers more at Everton and didn't.
Yeah.
But there is, you know, on the sort of positive side of the ledger, that there is some evidence that some players at least have come through.
Right. Okay. I completely accept that. But the statement you made before that is the one about these players who we've not developed enough, and I guess you know we need. You know, I suppose one that immediately springs to mind would be Luke Garber, who was on the fringes of first team football 3 or 4 years ago, and now he's gone. don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, we're naming individuals here when God knows how many players that are in the system. I just wish that the system within Everton from 10-year-olds all the way through didn't appear to come to a grinding halt at under 23 level. I just wish that the conveyor belt of talent was such that we could two or three every season would be fit and able to step up to the first team squad, and their peers who were alongside them who are not seem to be good enough could then be sold, you know, to go and pursue their career elsewhere, but for a decent return.
Maybe this is why Carlo Ancelotti made such a point of saying, "I'm here for the long haul," because he would know, a man as soaked in soccer as he is, how long it takes for a philosophy, which he most certainly has got, because he's got a favoured formation, and you know, he has sorted out the zonal marking mess that Marco Silva introduced us to. He would know better than anybody how long it's going to take for all that to filter through, for Everton to find a style,
right,
which can be taught, and a philosophy on how you play.
So, do we assume then that work hasn't quite started yet?
I think I wouldn't be surprised if he was here for him to say, "I'm treading water at the moment, mate. You can't make bricks without straw. And if I've got a midfield that can't tackle..."
That's the phrase I was going to use, Arkid. Since he arrived, has he in effect been treading water? Because the initial target was, for Christ's sake, we cannot go down. We've got to stay in this division, you know. And he comes in and says, "Well, I want to coach in Europe because I'm a European Cup, I'm a Champions League winner." But actually, the work on developing that Everton way, that Everton system, that complete ladder of progression from 10-year-old to the first team, the work on that hasn't actually begun in earnest because he's been too busy.
I think it probably has between him and Brand.
Right. Okay.
I hope so, Andy. Otherwise, talking the blues is going to.
But at the same time, Brands is probably more than acutely aware that he's got an incredible amount of wheeling and dealing to continue.
That's true, but he comes from a tradition and from a country which is Cruyff's country. It is used to, this is the way this team play. He knows that philosophy. So long as he and Ancelotti stay there together, I think there are very good times ahead. I do not think they are in a mad rush for next season. But, you know, if they can find the way to I'll wait. If they can find the way to do it.
Yeah,
and I think we have to wait because, the Aston Villa game and the Wolves game and the Tottenham game and the Southampton game, these are the best players he can pick at the moment. It's a shambles. I found myself, this is to make you laugh, found myself during the Aston Villa game going, shouldn't have sold Schneidlin. Where's Umar Nias when you need him? You know, that bad. At least Schneidlin, for all how slow and lazy he was, he did know how to tackle, and he did know why you should tackle. You watch the forwards, and they're just almost playing with their shoulders down because they know the midfield's not going to win the ball and supply them with it. Go on, change the subject, talk about something else.
Well, the only other thing I wanted to say about Project Restart is we said right at the outset of it that the scheduling of the games was going to cause havoc with players' fitness and injuries, and not just for Everton, for all clubs. And I think, we lost Gbamin before Project Restart got going, and we've had Mina in and out of the side, and he's now done for the final two games. Delph was never there. Walcott got injured, and now Holgate has got hurt, which is a shame because he's had a terrific season, Mason Holgate, and it's such a shame that he's missed out on the last three games because he was only on 15 minutes through the night. It's a real shame for that boy because he has had a terrific season. The saving grace has been that, I suppose, Michael Keane's come back to a little bit of form, but overall, I think the effect on the squad of so many games in such a short space of time, when they're low on confidence anyway, I think it certainly hasn't done Everton any favours, and I'm sure there are other clubs who ruin the fact that Project Restart did go ahead.
Where does that leave us?
I'll argue with that, Andy.
I agree. Where does that leave us then for next season? If, as believed, the season's going to be quite condensed. It's obviously not going to be as intense as this short period has.
Mm-hmm.
But they're going to be playing, a number of games in a much shorter period of time. So rather than starting we start the Premier League season middle of August, we're going to be starting the next Premier League season the beginning of October, six, maybe six, 7 weeks.
So probably the first 4 or 5 weeks of the season generally sees about 7 or 8 games, doesn't it? So it's going to compress it.
Yep.
By that, and that's why I say it's a blessing in disguise now with the squad we've currently got that we're not going into Europe, because throwing those Europa League games as well, and they'd be playing every third day. Which patently it's not good for the health of the players. It can't be, not with the rate of injuries, and as we said, you know, muscle strains, etc., etc. You know, it is a blessing in disguise that we won't be in Europe next year, and I dread to think how, you know, are the other coaches who are on the fringe, still on the fringe of it, Chris Wilder and Sean Dyche and whatnot, are they actually thinking, ooh, do we want this on top of a compressed season? I don't know. It's going to be hard, but
it's not only the season that's compressed, is it? It's this period between the end of this season and the beginning of next season.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was listening to something last night. And saying essentially the players are going to have a maximum of 2 weeks off before they're back into pre-season training.
Right.
Well, they have had 10 weeks off.
Is there almost a case for saying, right, you're not having your 2 weeks summer holiday because you've had 10 weeks off in March and April or what have you. We'll have a wind down training period for 10 days and then we'll ramp it up again.
I think the people I was listening to were pretty firm on the idea that the players are going to bugger off sort of
right.
6 o'clock next Sunday after the last game.
Yeah, they're straight out of there, aren't they?
Yeah, and you know they'll have their private planes waiting for them at Liverpool Airport to fly them to wherever it is that they're going to spend the next 2 weeks,
right?
Which is, you know, what happened at the end of last season.
Yeah, they were out of there pretty quick.
Where several players were, they finished the game, and next morning you find out that they're in Dubai already, or you know, wherever it is that they prefer to take a holiday break.
Mm.
So, I can't see many of the players wanting. Or not wanting to take that 2 week break.
No. Yeah. And I suppose if we were in their position, we'd want a 2 week break after eight games in 6 weeks or whatever it's been since we got back underway. But I just hope, Paul, that if they do get the 2 weeks away in the sun and relax and wind down and reflect on things, I just hope then that when they do come back to Finch Farm to start pre-season training for next season, that between them, they all come back ready to work the socks off and get fitter than they have been at any point in this season. Because the energy levels, certainly in the last few weeks and pretty much throughout the season, have been considerably lower than many of the opposition we've faced week in, week out.
Yeah.
Horribly true.
I totally concur with that. The other impact of everybody disappearing for 2 weeks after next Sunday's final games is that I think there will be very little transfer. I mean, I don't think there's going to be a lot of transfer activity generally anyway. But I think there will be very little transfer activity in the very early stages of the transfer window, because the transfer window actually opens next Monday, so the day after the end of the season. You know, there's an awful lot of talk in the media about putting bids in for this player, putting bids in for that player.
Mm-hmm.
I can't see any of that activity actually happening immediately after the end of the season.
When was it they announced or it leaked that we'd made a bid for Højbjerg of Southampton? Was that immediately after the Villa game the other night, or was it after the Wolves game?
I think it was
the Villa game, Andy. Whilst the Villa game was being played, they made a bid.
Right. So, but now it's being reported that Højbjerg actually would prefer to go to Spurs because he fancies European football.
Yeah.
Even though I read somewhere this morning that Spurs might not have the wherewithal to buy him because of all their other debts and etc. I mean, if the piece in The Athletic suggested that Ancelotti is really, really keen on Højbjerg, but Højbjerg doesn't seem keen on us. It begs the question, is it right to continue a chase for a player who seems iffy and undecided about whether he actually wants to join Everton Football Club? Could we be signing another? If that deal were to go ahead, are we bringing in a player who's going to rapidly become unhappy unless everything else gels the way we want it to? Or am I being overly negative that we're going to be as poor next season as we've been this season?
Well, if I was the player, my question would be, because obviously Brands and Ancelotti will put on a charm offensive to talk him into coming to us and not Spurs. My question would be, who else are you aiming to get? Because he, more than anybody, will know exactly what Everton are up to, because he had a marvellous night the other night at Goodison, just strolling around, nobody tackling him. Like a practice match for Southampton. They just pinged it about all over the place, didn't they?
From a business side, then, when we've already said that we don't think there's going to be £60 million on, or to be spread on three £20 million players, but isn't there an argument, and this isn't me making the argument, I'm just posing the question,
sure,
that maybe Everton need to get their transfer business, their incoming transfer business, done rapidly? If Ancelotti has earmarked a central defender, a midfielder and a right winger, as has been suggested, that we move quickly and get those deals done early doors so that the rest of the summer is left to Mr. Brands to try and engineer as many departures as possible to offset those three early checks.
I think that yes, on one count you're right. It obviously makes sense if we can do the transfers immediately, we should do so. But the flip side to that is, one, first of all, cash flow. Can we actually afford to do that? And secondly, if we do make acquisitions before we make sales, as you already said, it's a buyer's market.
Mm-hmm.
And people will know that we have to sell the players that we haven't yet sold.
So they'll play double hard ball with us.
So it puts us in a difficult position as a selling club, an even more difficult position as a selling club. So while instinctively you might think, yes, it makes sense to get the acquisitions in as quickly as possible, I actually don't think we'll do that. I think we'll try and move the players that we can move. Maybe loans, I don't know, but whoever we can move out, and then we'll do the acquisitions.
Right, but I read Ancelotti saying he hopes it's done early, so he's got the longest possible time to train with this new squad.
Oh, absolutely, from his perspective, he wants it done on the 27th of July.
Right.
All I'm doing is saying yes, but I think given the circumstances that we and all clubs find ourselves in, that may not be the case. There is an argument for the selling club to sell as quickly as possible, because if we do acquire one of these players that we're putting bids in early, then that club has that money available for its own purchases. So there may be one or two clubs. At Southampton, I don't think so, because Southampton financially are in a reasonable position. But there may be one or two clubs who are forced sellers. And I think the people that we will end up buying are people that you just won't hear about in the media.
Right.
I think we will end up surprising people with who we actually acquire and where we acquire them from. I think a lot of Premier League clubs are going to be looking at the English Football League and seeing are there any homegrown players? Are there any players in the English Football League currently who we can acquire cheaply? Because the English Football League clubs are in a really difficult position. So I see less international transfer activity and much more domestic transfer activity.
Right.
Which probably means that players that, you know, aren't on the radar.
The other thing as well is we've got players likes of Yannick Bolasie, who's gone on record as saying he wants to stay and fight for his place.
Yeah. Because he's on a contract that he's never going to get anywhere else.
Yeah.
With the greatest respect to the man. You know,
yeah.
By all accounts, he's a decent guy and everything else. I'm not criticising him for that. I'm just saying he is not going to get a contract anywhere else, anywhere near the contract he's on at Everton.
I suppose the same, similar with the likes of Mo Besic as well.
Yeah.
And Sandro Ramirez, there's any number of them, isn't there?
Well, you know, it all comes back to, these are all legacy issues from the ridiculous activities that went on.
From the profligate era.
In 2017 and 2018.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And then there's Tosin, who got injured. So that sale to Crystal Palace is probably unlikely to happen, isn't it?
One would think so. Just as an aside, I don't know if you watched it. In that article that I wrote about Mashiri, I included a video clip of Mashiri. And I don't know if you listened to it. It's absolutely fascinating listening to it, because he was talking about having brought Tosin in. And bringing Tosin in because Tosin was going to be the guy that would develop DCL.
Right.
It didn't quite work out that way.
No, it hasn't, has it?
No. I watched Mashiri talking up to the point where the eulogy is about Sam Allardyce and how he's followed him around and is thrilled to bits. And you kind of go, oh, my God. Nice as you could be about Sam, you wouldn't want to watch his teams play football.
No.
No. Thankfully, we don't need to do that anymore.
No. But as you've just said, we are paying the price for, you know, poor decisions, a string of poor decisions, and all of them costing us big money.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're up against a money wall. And, you know, as we've said in this podcast, the chickens are coming home to roost because we have not got the replacements within the club.
Yep.
No, yeah. It looks as though we are going to have to go outside again. Just got to hope, really hope, that whatever deals are done are a damn sight more successful than any number of the deals that have been done over the last 3 years. Because we can't afford to have another hit and miss window where we bring two or three players in or who don't A, gel and hit the ground running and produce what we desperately need. Like I said, if we can't go into next season without having a midfield that makes a tackle. Somewhere we've got to find that midfield general, and we've got to find a leader.
It's
whether it's Højbjerg or from Southampton or another from wherever. Whoever we bring in they've got to be the real deal.
It's an engine, Andy,
and
the way that, you know, Peter Reid wasn't quick, but he was an engine.
Yeah.
And we haven't got one, and it should have been Tom Davis, but I'm losing faith with Tom Davis, unfortunately, and I hope he proves me wrong. Nothing nicer than going, "Oh, my hands up." He's really pulled it out, but I'm not sure he will now. And how are we doing for time? Or would you like a quiz?
Yeah, I think we should go on to the quiz.
Go on then. Okay. Some of these are startlingly easy, and some of them are not. Right. Hang on, let me find it. Oops. Here we go. Okay. Toss a coin. Heads or tails, Andy?
Tails.
Whoops. Okay, Paul. Thomas Gravesen arrived at Everton in 2000. From which club was he purchased?
Thomas Gravesen, which club?
Oh. He's struggling, Andy. He's struggling.
So am I.
I didn't know this. What you would give for Tommy Gravesen, that midfield?
Hamburg.
Correct, Paul. One. Okay, Andy. Yours are the easy ones, mate. For which team was Peter Beardsley purchased?
From which team was Peter Beardsley purchased?
Purchased,
Liverpool.
Yeah. Correct. Oh, I said some of them were easy. Roberto Martinez replaced David Moyes in 2003. To which position did he take Everton in his first season?
In 2003?
2013.
Oh, yeah. First season, fifth.
Correct.
74
okay,
points.
Okay, Andy.
Yep.
Yep. Andy, who was the manager of Everton before David Moyes?
Before David Moyes?
Yep.
Before David Moyes. Crikey. No, we're not talking about a short-term interim here, are we? We're talking about
No, this guy was there for a couple of years, I think. My follow-up question would be why?
Hang on. Was it Walter Smith?
Correct, Andy. Two each.
Yeah.
We'll say. And now Paul gets a really rock-hard one. Good. How many of these goals did Inchy Heath score for Everton?
99.
Oh, that's so far out. I'm going to give you a chance for a thingy bob, Andy.
Give us a question again, please, Arkid.
How many league goals did Inchy Heath score for Everton?
League goals?
League goals.
He scored 99.
All right, do I adjust this, Paul?
He scored 99 in total, didn't he?
I don't know. It doesn't mention that. But the question is, how many league goals did Adrian Heath score for Everton?
I would have said about nothing like that number. I would have said about 68.
Okay, I'm going to give this point to the person who comes nearest. What are you going to say, Paul? It looks like you're right that they've included other competitions. How many league goals did and Adrian Heath score for Everton? And his bid is 68. What's yours?
69.
You sneaky little sod, that's really competitive. Correct, 71. okay, Andy, you get a nice easy one. Goalkeeper Neville Southall began his Everton career, blah, blah, blah. Who did we buy him from?
We bought him from Bury.
Correct. Okay, Paul, another harder. Maybe, I don't know. Three each. Who scored the last goal for Everton in the 1985 European Cup Winners' Cup semi-final against Bayern Munich?
Trevor Stephen.
Yeah. Correct. Very good. Okay. Andy.
Yeah.
In Roberto Martinez's final season at Everton, the squad performed poorly in the league but reached two semi-finals. Man United were the FA Cup semi-finalists and eventual winners, but who knocked Everton out of the League Cup semi-final?
Man City.
Correct. Boys, this is impressive. You're going too fast. I have to scroll down. Hang on. I don't believe this question. Gosh, whose is this, Paul? I want you to think hard about this, Paul. Who are Everton's arch rivals? That's not a quiz.
Tranmere.
Incorrect, Andy. Try again, but close geographically.
Southport.
I'm going to nullify that question. No, it's a, I'm going to give you the point, even if you don't answer, Paul.
I'm not. I refuse to answer.
You're quite right. You get the point, though. Okay, Andy, a little harder. From whom did Everton sign Alan Stubbs?
Bolton.
I beg your pardon?
Bolton Wanderers.
That's going over to you, Paul, for a clincher.
Oh, is that the last question?
No.
Oh, right, sorry.
And the big cards for...
Celtic,
where did Everton sign Alan Stubbs from in 2000, Paul?
Celtic.
Correct. I'm going to take 1 point off, Paul, for that ridiculous question about who Everton's arch rivals are.
Yeah.
So it's 5-4, Andy, as we come to you.
No,
is that right?
Paul's question.
No, we're going to Paul. Thomas Radzinski joined Everton in 2001. From which team?
Oh, you're really making me think now.
Good luck. Five, four in this behind closed doors match.
Was it Anderlecht?
But he's a bastard for that, isn't he? It is Anderlecht. Well done, Paul. Excuse my language. 6-4, Andy, but this is this could hardly be easier. What score did Everton beat Rapid Vienna in the European Cup Winners Cup final? What you were at?
3-1.
Correct. Ronald Koeman, Paul, was sacked on the 23rd of October 2017 after just a season in charge and was succeeded by Sam Allardyce. However, in the interim period, a former Everton player temporarily left his job as manager of the under-21 plane and became caretaker manager for 8 games.
Rhino.
This was?
Rhino.
Correct. 7-5, Andy. Who did Everton play in the 1985 Cup Winners' Cup final, what you were at?
Rapid Vienna.
And would you like to give us the 3 goal scorers?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Sheedy got the 3rd. Trevor Stevens scored at the back post. And... Andy... Oh,
you're right.
Frankie.
Andy Gray, right. Yeah. Andy Gray.
Yeah.
Whose question is it? 7-6. It's yours, Paul.
Who
did Everton buy Bob Latchford
from? Vienna?
Pardon?
Sorry?
Hans Krankl.
Rapid Vienna?
Hans Krankl.
Yeah, well done.
Who did Everton buy Bob Latchford from? Paul?
Birmingham City.
Mm-hmm. Correct. 8-6, Andy. It's nail-biting. Right. When Howard Kendall left as manager of Everton at the end of 1987, who did he join?
Athletic Bilbao.
Very good. 8-7. The 2018 World Cup was a good time to be an England supporter as an Evertonian, as one of the club's players made the start in England lineup. Who was it?
2018?
Yeah.
Pickford.
Correct. 9-7. Andy, how many league goals did Dixie Dean score for the club?
Oh, God.
I hate to tell you, but I bet Paul knows this.
Yeah, I know he will. League goals.
Yeah. I'm going to give you a little bit of leeway, but not much.
378.
Paul, do not say 377.
I know he scored 349 goals in total, but I don't know.
They were all league goals, according to this. That can't be right, can it?
He scored 349 goals in 399 games for Everton.
According to this, he scored 349 league goals. It's inconceivable he never scored in the Cup.
No, he scored a goal in the 33 Cup final.
Yeah,
he did, yeah.
Header at the back post.
Yep. I'm afraid I'm going to give in that point as well. Our kid. Duncan Ferguson. Whose go is it?
Paul's. No, Andy's.
There's two questions left. It must be Paul's.
Yeah, that was my question, Paul. Failed miserably.
Yeah. Duncan Ferguson, where was he signed from?
Which time?
Sorry, say that again.
Which time? You give me both clubs.
He came from Rangers on loan.
Yep.
And then he went to Newcastle and came back.
Correct. And finally, Andy, how many trophies did Howard Kendall win with Everton as a player?
As a player?
Yeah.
One. Oh, well, if you're counting Charity Shields...
I don't think we are.
Right. One of the 69-70 league title.
That's exactly what it says on the card. One, 1969-70 league championship.
Yeah.
I'm afraid Paul has... won this? Well, I'm not afraid. Well done, Paul. 10-8.
I'm having a serious word with Mum and Dad about you.
Do you think I should be more biased, Andy?
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't dream of it, bro.
Great stuff.
Good fun.
So, what's the prize, George?
The prize, I'm working on that. We'll have one of those at the end of the restart season. It could be a ticket to see me in a play. That'll keep me quiet for a year and a half.
The second prize is two tickets.
Yeah, absolutely. How dare you?
Oh dear. Well, we'll talk again probably after Sheffield United.
Aye. Monday night.
Monday night, and then the last game is next Saturday, is that right?
Next Sunday.
All right.
When they all kick off at the same time.
Yeah, all kicking off at the same time. 4 o'clock.
Yeah. And then we can go on holiday.
Yeah. I've got my private plane already. Trouble is, it's at John Lennon Airport and I can't get there.
Oh dear,
the problems. First world problems, George.
Yeah.
All right. Listen, thanks very much, guys. Really appreciate you spending your Sunday afternoon talking the Blues.
No problem.
And,
no problem at all.
Everybody who's listened to us, thanks so much. And excuse me, we'll speak to you soon.